Welcome to Related Bits Radio. I have a guest, Alan Watt, on the line from Canada, Ontario, I believe. And it's been what, 2.5 years, I think, since we last spoke, Alan. Myself and Brian Girish spoke to you. And a lot has happened in that 2.5 years alone, never mind the hundreds of years before that. But things certainly seem to be speeding up. And I said at the time, 2.5 years ago, that I was surprised at how many people hadn't heard of your radio program and the knowledge you had and about the whole system.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to let you introduce yourself again, to say how you became aware of the big system, as it were, from your early days at school, from what I've heard you say. I mean, I'm not sure where about in Scotland you're from, but your accent's fairly close to mine. So I'm guessing kind of East Coast or borders or somewhere like that. I'm not sure. But, you know, you've mentioned before that fairly early at school, you can start to realise things were wrong. So, I mean, if you want to just introduce yourself and say how you got into this, as it were, from way back when.
Well, what really happened was I was born into it. We're all born into it. It's just that we're caught up immediately that we're born with the indoctrination from the parents, who don't understand themselves, that they're living through a big planned society, a planned system, a planned culture that's always being updated and altered. And we adapt. This is the whole secret to everything. We adapt, as the big boys know, as the Darwinians know too, to every situation. We adapt to the new normals. And the new normals can be pushed by mass marketing, cultural shifts, entertainment, for instance, is a big thing. And I realized very, very young that everything was simply wrong, because I lived in a very working class area. All the towns around me were working class, mainly mining towns and so on. And when you're young, you can walk in and out of everybody's homes with your pals. And in every house that you went into, if there was any strain that you walked into, you'd feel the strain amongst adults. And it was always about the same things. Basic things in those days, which was basic money for rent, money for clothing for the children, food. Food was a basic thing, but very important. And everybody scrambled every week to make ends meet. They didn't have credit cards in those days, remember? You couldn't, if you're working class, you couldn't get loans from the banks for anything. Yet you did have that, what you call tick or credit, where certain people would come around the houses and you could buy second-hand furniture. Everybody bought second-hand furniture. And you paid that up on tick. The guy would come around every week and you'd give him half a crown and that was your tick it off, you see. So this was normal, you see. And when you're in that situation, you see, is it normal? Why is it normal? And then, of course, once you get to school, your real indoctrination starts. And you're given fake histories and everything else, and you're given a history of conquest of the British Empire. And I thought, well, if we've got this conquest of the British Empire that had been all over the planet for 200-odd years, how come everybody, pretty well the majority of the public, had nothing, you see? And that's when I went into to find out why. I had to find out why. I realized that we're living in a fixed income system. And the older I got, the more I validated all that, because you saw the starting wages across the whole of Britain for different trades, occupations, were always the same, very low. Apprenticeships were a great con, because you were basically in slavery for about 4 or 5 years. You didn't get enough to pay for your bus fare to the work, so you needed parents that had extra cash to pay just to get you through those 4 or 5 years. Things like that. And it wasn't really till much later they were getting a little bit extra cash for the very first time. Not because the big boys at the top that controlled the whole system wanted to. It was to simply keep the people a bit quieter and calmer as they made big changes in society. The happier folk are with their spending money, more income, the less they'll object to the big changes that are being forced upon you, like mass immigration, things like that. So anyway, I realized very early on, as I say, that the history was all fake. I was lucky in a sense that I got the different scholarships thrown at you. And so I got access to to better a bit better education from the different classes, which only again validated what I already knew. And then I was given permission to get library books from the adults' libraries, and so on. And so I did, and I really went into them, into the reference libraries. Now, some of the libraries were awfully good because they had old books going back to the 1700s, things like that. And I realized immediately that the histories were getting taught in Scotland, for instance, were completely altered from what was being written at the time, what actually happened. And I thought, well, that's probably universal across the whole British Empire system. And sure enough, in England too, they're always getting it changed. Ireland, Northern Ireland and Wales. And you catch on that you're living in a planned system that's meant to keep the peace by telling you a lot of lies while using you, of course. And I got older and all the rest of it. I got into different fields of work and professions, but I also was always in the music business. So that gave me the chance to travel very early. And I go back to professions afterwards and things like that. But going abroad, I realized that the same laws that were being passed by national government, say in Britain, were identical to the ones being passed at the same time by the national governments of Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and all parts of Europe. And I thought, well, this tells me there's already a system running all of these countries, working in concert, above the parliamentary level. And of course, it was later on I found out about the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And I really delved into that. So I thought, this is the key to everything here. I realized there's a big, long history to this organization, a private club, basically. Every media mogul that owned the newspapers, television, everything, every journalist, top journalist, was a member of this private organization. That gave us all a reality. Other members were members on all the big educational boards that decide the curriculum and what you'd be taught and what you wouldn't be taught. They gave us our complete reality. And the history of this group goes way back before they called themselves the Royal Institute for International Affairs. They called themselves the Cecil Rhodes Group and Lord Rothschild, who formed the Cecil Rhodes Foundation, and the Lord Alfred Milner Group. They combined eventually and formed the Royal Institute for International Affairs with a royal charter to exist with the power that they had. And this system was to give to the public what the public would believe was the rights of democracy, while this group actually ran the real government above it all and managed it all. And this is still in existence today. Across the whole British Commonwealth countries, they still have their Council on Foreign Relations under different names, by the way, now that so many folk have caught on to what they are. They're altering the names of their organizations in some of them. They even have one for every European parliamentarian. They belong to the European International Affairs Committee. So private groups didn't really just hijack the system. They created the system for you to make sure that they would always run it. They did not believe in democracy, but they know that the people wanted more freedoms and a thing called democracy. It was a new idea, even in the early 20th century. Winston Churchill talks about it, and who was pushing it, by the way. So you find that there's never been such a thing as democracy. Today, democracy is run openly, pretty well, by big international foundations that all work and are all part of this Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Ford, Carnegie, and Mellon Institute, a whole bunch of them, so many of them. They're tax-free charitable foundations with trillions and trillions of dollars each, some of them. They have hundreds of front foundations that they also finance through the main ones, and they run hundreds and hundreds of non-governmental organizations. So these non-governmental organizations are the ones that are told to lobby governments for plan changes, plans by, say, the big boys at the CFR, Royal Institute for International Affairs. And from the public's point of view, all they see in the papers is, oh, a democratic group, an NGO group, wants a change here and a change there and all the rest of it, never realizing that these private NGOs, the top members, know exactly where it's all supposed to go. It's not for the good of the people at all. They use environmentalism to the hilt. They've completely hijacked that. In fact, they started it up. And the top members and the NGOs even are on massive salaries, sometimes millions. a year, annum, per annum. Full pension packages, the whole thing, like a government worker. And they know what their role is to lead their crowds. And with very, very good intentions, often the crowd follows. But being misled into the great society, as they call it in Britain, which is communitarianism, a form of collectivism, based on all the studies they did in the Soviet system, with what they call improvements in the Soviet system. The new system to be implemented all throughout Britain, for instance, is the flagship for the rest of the world to follow. And in this new collectivist system is a Club of Rome, another think tank, because they own all these think tanks that advise governments. The Club of Rome, a high member of this, and they also advise the UN, came out in the 1970s in a book called The First Global Revolution. And they said that the real revolution is led by us and all of our members. Democracy will never work. See, they knew this from the beginning, even though they push it on us because we like the idea of it. And they pretend it's there, but they lead it all. And they said democracy will never work because there are too many competing factions all demanding special interests and special rights. They'll all be fighting for the big share of the honey pot, the taxpayers' money, you know. And that's already spoken for by the big foundations that run the whole system. So they said... we can't get anything, the big plans done. In other words, we're run by plans. Things just don't happen. The big boys in the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the CFR literally plan the 100-year plans, just like the Soviets did because they were heavily involved in the Soviet system. The United Nations has 100-year plans, 50-year plans for some things, 25-year plans for other parts of it, social changes. This change will be done within 10 years, etc., etc. It's run with military precision. And big international corporations are all members with these foundations. In fact, many of them were funded to start up as big international corporations by these foundations themselves. You find writings even by Albert Pike in the 1800s, who was a big player in international revolution. He was the Pope of Freemasonry in those days, you might call it. And Freemasonry, for the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, it wasn't Scottish at all, by the way, it came from France. But he said, we shall guide the world down the path we've selected. And he said, we shall, by using the stock market, which they created, by the way, the stock market and all kinds of vices, he says, we shall become the masters over the masters of the world. We're talking about taking over the world's fortunes and business, etc. That's been done, but they have created real corporations on the way. When you look at the big international meetings to do with the future, look at IBM as an example. Every major corporation will attend any IBM big meeting that they have, and they lay out the future, and all these other corporations that are associated with IBM and network with them are all part of this giant system of non-democratic systems, you see. What they leave and always use the term democracy as they push their system into other countries they haven't been in before. But it's under the guise of democracy, and there's no democracy at all. In actual fact, everything is completely rigged. You'll find that in the planned society, in the great society, etc., is Carl Quigley, Professor Carl Quigley, who was the historian and who was all for this agenda, for the Council on Foreign Relations, which is just another branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. They couldn't use Royal in America, for instance, so they called it the Council on Foreign Relations. But it's the same group. Ireland has it too, and so does Southern Ireland, by the way. And Quigley said, he said, the new system we're bringing in is a system where professionals and those academics will run the world. Professionals, experts. And he simply parroted other ones who were in the world meetings and wrote lots of books about it, like Lord Bertrand Russell. And they said, quickly said, the new system would be a form of feudalism, a new feudalism. Feudalism really hasn't ever died away. And in fact, there was an article in one of the Scottish papers this year, in fact, about the feudal system of Scotland is alive and well. where you've got really a bit less than a dozen lords, going back to the Norman times actually, who still own most of the land in Scotland, you know. So anyway, this new feudal system, he said, will have the new feudal overlords who will be the CEOs of international corporations. Every government today takes its cue in all matters from the big corporations, including, I would say, the institutions, the institutes, the private charitable foundations and institutions that advise them where to go. So really, you have puppet governments. Now, those in government at the higher levels all know this because they're all members of the Royal Institute for International Affairs and CFR too. Quigley went so far in his books. And remember, he had the archives of their version of history because they fill in all the blank bits to do with what, why the wars were really caused, what was to be gained from them, etc. He gives the history of them. And he said that wars have two reasons for happening in their philosophy. He said it not only standardizes a system across the world for globalism, but also, it says, you can get more done in 5 years of warfare, real war, in a cultural sense, than you can do in 50 years of persuasion and propaganda in peacetime. And that's true. During wartime, the government steps in, it takes over agriculture and many other areas of society that were in private hands and smallholders' hands and so on. And after the war, you're in a socialized system. Britain went into World War II fighting National Socialism, supposedly, an official version. But it came out as a socialist country. And it was internationalist. So the big boys use wars mightily to change societies and are still doing it today. That's what's going on in the Middle East, as they standardize the last few countries that will not join the World Bank, which was created and run actually by the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Alfred Milner Group. The IMF, which is also created by the Alfred Milner Group. And all the other, the Bank for International Settlements is a big one. Again, Quigley said, their own personal historian and archivist, he had all their archives, and he said, crisis after crisis will be caused economically, by deliberation. And he said that out of this, he says, every country will be tamed by the power of money, by professionals, and the Bank for International Settlements will be the main bank for the whole planet. That's happened. And eventually the IMF would come in as the collector of debt, and they would start running the politics of each country, which we already have, as you go into the countries and they cut the welfare systems, they cut the health systems and so on, and they loot the country to pay off the debt. He wrote about that back in the 1960s. But he said that since in that time, the 1960s, mid-60s, he said there hasn't been a president of the US or a prime minister of Britain or any other country in Europe that has not been a member of this organization with all of these goals in mind. He said, since the late 1800s. He says, it's not necessary we get all the rest of the politicians in. The other politicians are allowed a certain amount of competition down below. But all the top members and the prime ministers and presidents are always members of this organization. And advisors, by the way. Very important with advisors, because they really know the agenda. So we're living through a planned system. They're standardizing the world into the one system. And many players are on board with it, even the ex-Soviet boys, Gorbachev, etc. And Gorbachev wrote a lot about it too. He said that in one of his books, I think it was called Towards a New Civilization, he wrote quite a few actually, and they were written in the very primitive way that the communist leaders spoke to the ordinary folk. It was very almost childlike language, you know, very simple. But he said in the book that... I'm an atheist, he said, in an answer to a girl's question they put in the book. But he says, we, he didn't define who we were, but he says, we are in the process of creating a new world religion for the future, for the system they're bringing in. And it must be based on a form of earth worship. And what he was referring to was that massive indoctrination to come out into the schools, etc., across the world, in to bring them into conservation, because it was a tie-in with austerity, post-industrialism, post-consumerism, as they bring you into the new society, while at the same time they were raising what were called third world countries up to the to a higher status that were to be funded completely. And they are, by the way, through the World Trade Organization, set up again by the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So we saw it happen with China. Britain, by the way, most British people don't know that at the end of World War II, it was signed into agreements that Britain would not just demilitarize, but they would deindustrialize over a period of time. That was to start around the late 60s, escalate through the 70s and 80s into a completely deindustrialized society. During that time, the people who lived in Britain were never told that when the factories were simply disappearing, many of them were moving abroad, they weren't telling them that in the press, so thousands upon thousands, every week this was happening, getting laid off, layoffs. The suicide rate went through the roof in Britain because the youngsters had nothing to look forward to at all. And it actually overtook Sweden for the suicides rate, way beyond Sweden. But the people were never to be told. And during this whole period of time, they were setting up basically the new European system. Again, free trade was always designed to amalgamate into a government for the whole of Europe. And they lied from the beginning. They actually admitted in the late 90s, when they had got the parliament up and running in Brussels, they actually admitted after that, and they read some of their initial charter for the first time. They said that the public were never to know the real truth behind it all, and would be basically cajoled or lied to along the way until it was up and running, because the intention was always to unite the whole of Europe under a non-democratic system. Again, falling in with the Club of Rome, etc. Because tremendous upheavals as they deindustrialized the countries, and it certainly did. And as I say, the people were. Margaret Thatcher at one point came on national television and said, "There's a generation growing up in our lifetime that will never see employment." She said, "Get used to it. But there's a message for you for the future." But it was so important. Hello?
Yeah, carry on. I was just going to say, I mean, it should be obvious to many people in Britain now, and indeed Europe, particularly Greece, Spain, Cyprus, all these countries, that unemployment's here to stay under the guise of austerity. And I was in somebody's house the other day there, and just doing a bit of work for them, and this lady was talking to me about just bringing up things that were on the TV, because she was just sitting watching the TV all morning, this kind of morning garbage and so on. And she said, "Oh, this drugs thing's terrible. What do you think they should be doing about the drugs, you know?" And I said, "Well, if they stopped growing them, you know, that would help." Because the report had just come out in the papers over here that the bumper heroin crop in Afghanistan, you know, it had been a failure of British military policy. But of course, it was a success of British military policy, because that's exactly what they wanted. Mm-hmm. But going back to the whole historical side, the money, the military and religion, the three of them tie together in terms of the overarching control mechanism. Mm-hmm. And basically without money, none of the other two would really survive anyway. So, I mean, money is the crux. And as you say, it's been discussed in many, many meetings and written in many books in days gone by, that money would be used eventually to basically bring everybody under the thumb, as it were, of the international bankers.
Well, it's been done before, you understand. There's nothing new in this, and again, that's why we're kept in such ignorance.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted to go into. I mean, it has been done before, and religion's been used before, and the military's been used before. In terms of, I mean, the military, I mean, we'll get onto immigration later on, but I mean, that was another military tactic where tribes and groups of people were just shifted from one area to another to basically destroy any semblance of a homogenous culture in those countries. And the same is happening in Britain today and all over Europe and America and whatever. The history of money, I mean, I don't know how far back you want to go, but and as to when it started to be a the fundamental control mechanism. Do you want to go into that?
Oh, you can go back anywhere you want to, actually, and as far as what we know or given the histories of what they call civilization. Civilization itself, if you go into what is civilization? You have a written history, you have a leisure class that can only exist when others are laboring, either through slavery, which is all part of it too, to create that leisure class who's living awfully well. They don't have to go out and hunt and gather or plant or anything else. And we see that in Greece, for instance, and the philosophers in Greece talked a lot about it, where slavery was quite normal. And so was the same thing with the Empire of Rome. In fact, many of the top Greek aristocracy moved and became the Roman aristocracy. They were tied. In fact, even, I think it was Aristotle's wife was given to him by a big international lender who lived in Levant at the time. They were always tied in with the same people who always ran money. And massive wars were fought in ancient time to standardize money so that everyone would have to use it. Because a lot of folk didn't use money, remember. They bartered for everything they had. And when you look at the wars, even the wars with the Spartans, for instance, the Spartans held out for 100 years. Everybody else had caved in to stop the money system coming in with the people, with their rules, regulations, and dominance, and debt, and so on. And they hung on to their iron money, which was especially tempered iron that you couldn't crack or break or do all the tricks that the moneylenders had done before with other kinds of gold and silver and so on. And they held out for 100 years to stop that from happening. And what the moneylenders always had done is not do the fighting themselves. They lend to people, they go to kings and queens, and bedeck their wives with jewels and complain. We say, my God, you know, why isn't your wife bedecked with the same stuff as this guy over in this big city state over their house? And they get them into debt gradually. And then, of course, with money, the introduction of money, you can get a standing army. If you don't have the money, you can't get a standing army. The guys might plunder a bit, rape and pillage a bit, but eventually they just give up and go home and get fed up. But if you give them money there, then you've got a permanent standing army. With a permanent standing army, the money lenders could then use the debt of that country and force that country to war with the next neighbor to pay the debt, you see. This still goes on today. And you find that the money lenders, the history of them is fascinating because even in the ancient times at that particular period, as they were forcing, even the Phoenicians, they were forcing their system across the known world at that time, they had slave colonies set up all around the Mediterranean, and they had people that were conquered by other countries that were in debt to them, and they used they actually made a deal that would take so many slaves too in part payment for the debt you owe us after you fight these wars. And they set up these, much like free trade systems we have today, and they would do these free trade systems with the Phoenicians, run themselves, of course, and they used other countries to keep the peace and international force, whoever the force was dominant at the time, Greek or whatever. And so they've always accepted slavery as a normal thing. The Phoenicians eventually even had gold mines in the Ural Mountains back in those days. And they worked out that the average slave, which they had demanded in conquest by the armies or the countries that owed money to them and used their armies to conquer, they'd always demand so many slaves because they worked out that half an ounce per gold, they went through a slave per half ounce because there were no safety standards in those days. So the slave would die or get cave-ins and all the rest of it and the conditions. So they had a real going business and they studied people too, just like sociology does today, and behaviorism. And they knew too, they kept statistics on the life expectancy of slaves, etc. Very, very efficient according to them. But this has never stopped. This whole key of money created by, say, one or two groups down through history, left to those two groups in their hands, has to stop. If it doesn't stop, it's all over. It's very simple. Simple as that. Countries fought to create their own money to put into circulation. Canada was a good idea, a good example. During the Depression, it was the only country that didn't suffer the same massive debt and loss that every other country did because the Bank of Canada was a real bank at that time. And the Bank of Canada printed its own cash, and it was backed by something. It doesn't matter what it's backed by. Sometimes it's backed by something that's agreed upon. But the fact is, they spent it into circulation, and they sold it to the banks. So it wasn't debt money. It wasn't debt to begin with. They sold it. That paid for all and all the rest of it. Then the banks could lend it out further down. But they also spent money into all big building projects, construction, all the rest of it. And from all over during the Great Depression, they sent up from the U.S. Treasury and from Britain and other countries to see how this worked. But they wouldn't adopt it because they were already really conquered, those countries. And you'll find even when you go into the histories from the ancient times to the present, this has all been well understood. And again, religion sometimes, even though it forbid usury, would always give the right of usury to one group. They still did that because they wanted money to circulate, because they wanted the coffers to come back into the church too. So it's quite interesting to see who's going to win in a system where money is made to be the norm and absolutely necessary, a substitute for planting, growing, and everything else. That's what it is. And you give the power to one group who decides the value of it at any one time, or the devaluation of it too. Who's going to prosper during thousands of years compared to all the rest are not allowed to use usury? Tell me that. It's very simple, you know.
Well, of course, Alan, I mean, we're all still in the slavery system because as long as you be taxed, then you're a slave. And
we're using the same system. We're using the same system, and it technically is run by the same people down through history. And no one asks why. It's almost forbidden. But the fact is, it's a disgusting system, and you can never have any kind of freedom of any kind. So it's all a show or smoke and mirrors if you believe you've got freedom and you're still in the same system. Now, Charles Galton Darwin, who a descendant again of Darwin, and he was a physicist, a top physicist in the 1940s and 50s, and he worked on the A bomb and the H bomb with Teller. He wrote a book. He was a complete eugenicist too. It runs in the family, obviously, but he said he wrote a book called The Next Million Years. And it was written on behalf of the world's elite that already ruled. And he said in the book that there's always been slavery down through history in one form or another. He says, we, meaning the world's elite, that all these world meetings on depopulation, the system they're bringing in, and etc. He says, we are in the process of creating a new, more sophisticated form of slavery. And the slavery system is one where the people would be taught that had rights and they had freedoms, and so they'd really believe they were free. But in reality, they would think that everything's normal. You're born into taxation, as you say. You're born into paying off a previous generation's debt, even though you didn't legally put your name down. You weren't even born. So you're living in a constant, ongoing debt slavery system. Jefferson talked about this too. Thomas Jefferson, it says, when any generation is born into a system and obligated to pay off by law a previous generation's debt, it said they should have a rebellion and overthrow it and refuse. Well, how many generations have gone before? We're still paying off the debt. Britain just paid off the debt in the late 90s for World War I. They're still paying the debt for World War II, the Korean War, the other conflicts they had in Cyprus and other countries, and the ongoing ones today all over the Middle East for this global system. You're handed the bill. The average person in the generations to come are handed the bill for all these wars that benefit BP, Shell Oil, and all the big boys that go over to plunder the Middle East as we pretend we're bringing freedom and democracy to them. That came out in the papers, by the way, in Britain this year, where it was admitted by the staff of Tony Blair that during that time, he says, before they even invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, he said, that the companies, because it was all ordained long before 9/11 happened, they said that all the big boys from the oil companies came in and had big, big meetings to see how they would divvy up the spoils of war amongst themselves. Nothing new. And this is this is the 21st century, and this is still going. Nothing has changed whatsoever. So Britain's a great example. I mean, you take the conquest of India. The British taxpayer funded all the wars in India for private companies, by the way. The taxpayers in Britain paid for the railroad lines to get laid down, which are still working, getting used today. And the systems were to be set up for governments in India, and so on. You pay for all of this for private corporations to plunder the countries and prosper. They did the same throughout Africa and every other country in the world where they've gone to. So you're left with the bill. That's what you get as a taxpayer under democracy. And the big international corporations, with their big players based in London and New York and elsewhere, live in their massive mansions because they get the spoils of it all down through the centuries under Great Britain and the Empire. The average person is left with a bill, massive debt, and sometimes living in utter squalor, but always in neurosis and fear and worry and so on of what's next. Can I get through today? That's reality, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm 50 years old now. I've been working for 35 years, and I'm certainly no better off, and in fact, I'm a lot worse off than I was 20 years ago. And many people at my age and older. Are in the same position. There is no progress to be made, to use that word. We're kept at this basic level of existence. And I've heard you talk many times about the way it's going to go. Is that all disposable income will be it won't be disposable anymore. It'll be accounted for before you even get it, and it'll be sent off to the big electricity companies, the water companies, all the rest of it. We'll go to a piece of music, I suppose, quite appropriate, I suppose, because this is called Home, and people are losing them right, left, and centre, which is another example of theft, basically, of people's assets, deliberately and by design, by the bankers. So the bankers are going to be the global landlords at the end of the day, and will be at their behest. So this is the first piece of music. Welcome back to Reality Bites, guest Alan Watts on the 21st of November, 2013, and we were talking off air there about the history of this whole system, and there was a few people in the chat box that had a few questions from colleagues of mine earlier in the day and earlier in the week about the whole religious side of things. Some of my friends are in Ireland, and they're well aware of how it's been used over there to control society, not so much nowadays, but it was certainly a big player over the last century or so. But the whole history of religion, I mean, is there any kind of starting point for where religion was brought up as an idea of how they could control society outside the money system, outside the military, giving them a belief system?
Yeah, people are naturally inclined towards a spiritual side of things, and I think personally it's part of a survival mechanism too, because it all started in some tribe or other long ago. So it gave you a simple moralities and taboos that you shouldn't break or the tribe suffers, you see. And when you're living for basic existence and sustenance and so on, you have to have basic rules to stop any dissension within the tribe, even mass promiscuity. You'll have unwanted children that have to be fed, but by whom? If there's no dads and so on, you know, you don't have a welfare system, etc. So you have basic taboos, which all work very well, very simplistic taboos, everybody knows them, etc. You didn't need police. And you didn't have to pay extra cash for a chief that lived like a king and queen. Basic chiefs lived like the rest of the public. They didn't have anything more than you did. And that way, too, they couldn't get too big for their boots with a standing army to protect them. Therefore, if someone did become a bit psychopathic, it was easy for the rest of the tribe to overthrow them and get rid of them. Once that system was overgone by money, because money brings in, again, the Praetorian Guard type thing around the elite. And then in the next village, of course, you have the same, or town or city state, you'll have the same thing going on. And so they start intermarrying each other. And you have a psychopathic rulership, you see, because those who seek power and who are clever enough to be manipulative and persuasive, but ruthless at the same time, are psychopathic. These are the ones who unfortunately get to the top in a moneyed system. Always will be. Always has been, always will be. And therefore, the intermarry are the daughters of psychopaths too. So there's a lot of hereditary traits there. And the people can't overthrow them because they do have a big army to protect them, etc. That's been the way for an awful long time now. and the elites are firmly established. But again, too, some people's, even the ones who ran the money systems, had the same kind of system that they all thought they were elite, all the money boys, the big money boys in times gone by. And it's very tribal, in fact, very tribal and elitist, right to the present day. And so we must never forget that. There are still tribes vying for power today. It's unfortunate for the people of Scotland and some other countries. They can't see that so well. But you'll find that the most powerful people who still retain their real tribalism and intermarriage with their own all came from the same areas of warm climates, by the way, not cold climates. And you've gone to anthropology, they have a lot of reasons as to why that is. There was less people in the cold climates, and you had to be friendly with people you had never met before, little small groups, for your survival's sake, and an exchange of foodstuffs and things like that for your survival. In the warmer climates, tribes grew big, and they all vied with each other for power, and they're all pretty well inbred. And they still do the same today, by the way. It doesn't matter where they go across the world, they still send home for their wives or whatever. And that's never been answered yet as to what's to happen with all of that. But we had two involved in the moneyed system, it's right down through time. But in the Middle Ages, you found that when successful tribes that work collectively, and this is the thing too with collective societies of real tribal peoples, they're very collective. They can work together. And when they go into other countries that are not collective, more individualistic, for instance, like say Scotland or parts of Europe, etc., they always succeed because they're working collectively. They monopolize things. Very, very, very successful. And that causes massive dissension. So when the peoples of those countries eventually recognize them as completely different and taking over, they try to have them evicted. And this has happened down through time too, even with the moneyed peoples. So you had in the Middle Ages, just prior to Luther, different factions of people who were in contact with the disaffected peoples, and they started to learn for the first time about their religion that they believed in themselves, and the interchanged ideas. And out of that came the first, you may call them secretive societies. There was different forms of them. The Bogomils were one. They were the same as the Cathars. They were well-structured, and their idea was to cause dissension within the ruling church at that time, which was the Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church in Europe, and to cause doubt, etc. Later on, they broke out under different guises, different names. Rosicrucianism was one of them. And so you add mysticism to people who are often illiterate. All they know is their indoctrinated religion. And most of them had never read a Bible, and in fact weren't allowed to in some religions, Christian religions. And so they couldn't question anything, but they were questioning just through word of mouth by all the disaffected groups they were in touch with. And it got so bad around the time of Luther. I mean, Luther wasn't the only one that was pushing for a form of revolution. There was other groups too. When people started to get a hint of the fact that the religion they were following was really a structure of power control, it was a power control structure. They never really thought about it that way before. They thought it was simply for spiritual guidance, but it was a power structure that was really meant to keep an agricultural society in a feudal system. Because the old idea of godhood was that in fact, you actually saw this in the early Vatican, they had the Pope at the top in a descending pyramid order, all the different categories and ranks of priesthoods down to the bottom. And they represented the heaven in a reverse form. And they often in their drawings and their paintings, they'd have heaven coming down, ascending down to the ones below through the angels, and then taking on to see a pope, and then down through them. And actually, it worked awfully well for us in a sense, for the education that everybody had at that time. It wasn't a lot, so it kept a kind of form of structure and culture that worked, so the people wouldn't kill themselves all the time. and rob from each other, etc., etc. But it also, of course, from its inception, was taken over by a power elite naturally, with the money, etc., etc. There's always elitism. And so over time, like every institution, it becomes corrupt. And so it kept all the kings and the queens and so on in power, often tyrants too. And even though they said that, for instance, the Catholic Church was not meant to be involved in things of the world, they couldn't help but be involved in things of the world. They wanted sort of peace and quiet and some form of order in society, because all structures are for order. Even the primitive religions that don't get taxation and so on, they still want order for their lives to work. But of course, confusion reigns when you end up with the money system coming in and people who don't belong to that religion running the cash too, by the way. So you also, in the Middle Ages, you had breakaway factions that started off with ideas actually gotten from the money guys who taught them a form of Judaism. Now, these folk had only heard priests talk about stories from the Old Testament, but actual Judaism itself is a book of revolution. People don't realize that. It's about unjustness. It's about being persecuted. It's about fighting and rebelling in their history against different factions of that conquered them, etc., etc. So the Christians, eventually, they're the Christians, a lot of dissenters, they had nothing to fall back on of their own that gave them a sense of who they were or how to rebel, or even the fact that they should rebel. So they adopted that religion, the Old Testament, the Christians did. And they had revolutions throughout parts of Germany. They took over city-states. They appointed their own kings and queens eventually, little tyrants, by the way. They brought in free love in the 1600s, in some of them, free love. And it got so bad at one time, one of the guys, under this new form of what they thought was Christianity that was in rebellion using Judaism, they actually used all the terminology from the Old Testament to rebel against those that they saw as conquering them today. And so, because there's nothing else to take it from. That's the only thing that existed. It still is today, by the way. And so anyway, they thought that they should have all these freedoms and rights and so, and really do as they wanted to do. And it ended up in utter chaos. And the established people around those cities would attack them every so often, wear them down over 1 or 2 years, and eventually there was a mass slaughter at the end as the folk were starved out and went into absolute chaos. They brought in massive polygamy. They forbade women not to have sex with all these different guys. It was the 1960s with free love. It was incredible. They ordered the women they had to have sex with whoever man demanded it. But there were secret societies behind all of this. Even Luther himself realized, and he was against it too, he realized that it would put out his version of Protestantism. It would destroy it if he didn't turn against this movement. And he did, and he went on the side of the authorities. He said the rabble can never be allowed to have this kind of power. And he believed they were the rabble, you see. But then you find the same things happened later again, because the revolution in England, people forget, but the revolution in England was the first major revolution. And that's why you end up with red, white, and blue. Very, very important that. Where they brought in Kabbalism and the meanings of colours. It goes way back to Pythagoras too, a very old system, etc. And you find that Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, was in touch with the Jewish people even in Holland, to get a lot of information from them on what the religion was all about, you see. It wasn't just Joseph and his coat getting tossed in a pit and all that and making good, you know. And there was actually movements between some of these factions of disaffected people who were always successful being thrown out of countries because of being successful. But they had a lot of interaction. And some of the head ones wanted to begin an assimilation process for the first time between Judaism and Christianity, this new form of Christianity, which was based on the Old Testament. And that's what Cromwell based his whole theology on, the Old Testament. Rules, regulations. And because of that, he was a ruthless tyrant, of course. The Puritan movement came out of it too, the Puritan movement, which a lot of them went to America. So a lot of things were happening like this that people don't even get taught today, except in very high academic circles where they say it's safe to discuss these things. It's not safe, they say, to give this information to the ordinary people down below because they're emotive and they'll get angry and so on. So, yeah, the various revolutions going on, etc. Well, out of the Protestant movement, again, you still had this basis. The Protestantism is condemned always to fall into the Old Testament for rules, regulations, because the New Testament doesn't have all these rules. It's a dilemma, isn't it? Because the New Testament tells you how to get on with your fellow man, and it doesn't. And there's no demand that you do. There's no demand that the man must conform to you see, or your idea of thinking. The Old Testament is unforgiving in many, many ways. Rules, regulations, slaughter them if they're against you. Slaughter anybody who doesn't agree with you. The New Testament is love everybody, including your enemies. And so you got a real dilemma there. So Protestantism, well, it was always condemned to fall into the Old Testament because men crave rules and regulations, even though they go into absurdity and over-regulation on every possible area. The same thing happened within Judaism with the Talmud, the later Talmud, which is different from Judaism in a sense. It's nothing but rules and regulations about every possible topic you can imagine. And not even imagine. It's incredible. So Protestantism falls into the same thing. It's interesting for me to look at all of this and stand back from it and see even communism had a lot to do with this. Because they went into massive regulations, a form of socialism that was totalitarian, with massive regulations on every possible thing a person could do or not do and so on throughout their entire life. Your life was planned for you. We're in the same system today because the elite at the top bring in anthropologists, they bring in all the professors of religions, they bring in historians. Arnold Toynbee was a great example of international socialism. He advised the CFR and Royal Institute for International Affairs on many occasions, top member, on all the possible things. Carl Quigley himself was brought in for the same reasons. Because they tell the elites, here's how we can bring in our type of world, and they use all of these methods and the methodologies to run what they claim will be the perfect society of obedience. Obedience is the key to it all. A planned society where everyone would be born under the Soviet system that was adapted into this communitarian, eventually be tested at birth, and they'll decide what you're going to be if they need you, by the way. If they don't need you, you will not be born. This is the planned society, you see. And you will be taught when you are born, when they've tested you, what you're going to be trained in, and nothing else. You get taught just that one training and nothing else outside of that. Then there's no dissension. You can't be a problem down the road because you won't have the education in these other areas or the critical thinking abilities and knowledge.
Well, I mean, we're into Huxley's Brave New World in that scenario because you'll be born into the alpha, the betas, the whatever, and you'll
Yes.
be given your education perhaps in the same form as Brave New World, where you'll be put into a kind of incubator. And
Yeah.
this stuff will be drummed into you while you're sleeping or in some sort of comatose state or whatever. And
Well, it's even beyond that. It's
we're
way
not far
beyond
off
that
it. We're not
now.
far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
find
I mean,
that.
we're not far off it with the. Carry on.
You find that, for instance, I don't know if you've read the writings between Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and Orwell, George Orwell. There's a book out with their writings because they exchanged all this information about what kind of system they would bring in. And they belonged to international meetings with the elites, of course. Intergenerationally, by the way, it wasn't just with them. It was always in the same family groups down through the centuries, you know. And they'd already worked out all this way ahead. They knew that the jackboot type thug thing might be important. And we're going through that right now. We've got a combination of both on the go. We have total information network systems, total control on every one of us. As we're going through, under the guise of international terrorism, we're going through the force of all the black-clad guys across the world. It doesn't matter where you look, the cops all look like military troops, which they are actually today. So the fear factor is used to force us into. But it's where black, too, is the colour of the executioner. That's why they had them dressed in black. It's a fearful thing. Always works in psychology, regardless of the time period. Anyway, the hangman wore it too, remember, in the hood. So anyway, that's what we have today to make us fearful. As when we're fearful, we turn to government, the abuser, we turn to government to help us. And they've got all these professionals telling us how to behave and not to worry. And TV's a big tool on it, of course. The BBC is the world example of how do you control folk and prepare them through fiction and non-fiction for the future. So we're already in that system. It's a perfectly controlled society. The GIRFEC, as you know, was introduced in Scotland and caused a little bit of an uproar for those who followed it.
Just for those who don't know, that stands for Getting It Right for Every Child.
Yes. And now it's mandatory that every child born, regardless of your class system or anything else, doesn't matter, has a government-appointed bureaucrat, social worker or whatever, that must come from the age of about 2 months onwards and test you in different ways. And you must give access to your child to this bureaucrat whenever they demand entrance into your home. So they're also a legally appointed guardian. This is how they get it through. It sounds better, doesn't it? And they test them for even things like racist tendencies from an age of a few months onwards. Things like this. To make sure that if they detect any possible thought pattern in that child and lines of questioning from an intelligent child, they can nip it in the bud quickly and recondition them, you might say. Tweak them here and tweak them there to get them into the standard clone type system that they want to turn out. Predictable, a very predictable child, they'll turn into a predictable adult with all the proper indoctrinations, and that's all they'll be able to spout in public, in polite society, is the proper, accepted, authorised indoctrinations. That's all that will come out of them. And this isn't just in Scotland, it's in England too, under a different name. And the UN is behind it too. Even Sarkozy, that was the president of France, was a big proponent and designer of this system for Scotland. And Scotland is a test bed for tweaking it all. Because Scotland, by the way, the Scots were slated for being eradicated by some of the top economists of even the 1800s. John Stuart Mill. They had all the different peoples listed and according to ascending and descending orders of importance under a eugenical scheme and a Darwinistic scheme. And they said that the Scots and the Irish would have to be eliminated. H.G. Wells wrote about that too in his book, A History of the World. It's a two-book volume, the original one. And he said the Scots and the Irish, he says these people tend to rebel. They don't like being conquered. And it's true that I always say the Scots have an allergy against tyranny, you know, and so they'd have to be eliminated and wiped out. Hence the push in those countries to definitely multiculturalize them, and eventually very few of them are having children now, as you know. I couldn't believe the massive attack on Scotland during the late 70s and sped up through the 80s like crazy, as they brought in a massive immigration from India, settled in Edinburgh and places like this, and in with it came the massive drug problems and heroin, because the networks were all coming in with them. The governments knew this too before they brought them all in as part of the destruction process. And in no time at all, they brought those people down into utter despair. Utter despair. When you see children sitting on the steps outside their council homes and so on, with syringes hanging out their arms, and they're in a stupor. You got planned genocide. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that myself. I mean, I'm from Edinburgh, and yeah. I grew up in that kind of environment for many years, and eventually kind of got myself away into a kind of a nicer place to live, shall I say? But I was brought up on council estates when I was young.
Yeah.
And then I started working for an insurance company, and I used to have to go around, I don't know if you know the areas of Edinburgh, Granton, Pilton, mm-hmm. and these kind of areas where the tower blocks were.
Yeah.
And you would walk into these places and there'd be syringes and, I don't want to talk about used tampons, everything would be just lying in the stairwells, the lifts would stink of urine, and, you know, it was just awful. And those places are still there. Knocked a few down, but people think, oh, that's gone away, but... It's just the same as it ever was. I mean, I've never seen anything in those kind of areas get any better for anybody.
It's not meant to. It's not meant to.
No, of course. Well, obviously,
if you look at the Darwinist process of the annihilation of societies, and this is taught again in higher circles today. If you look at the American Indian, who lives in similar conditions, by the way, they say the American Indian will not adapt. You see, but they don't want him to adapt regardless. But you see the same squalor there. And what you see, and Darwin said it too, a superior culture will always destroy and cause the destruction of inferior cultures. But by using the techniques to understand, they can also cause an equal society, not inferior, to self-destruct. When you destroy its culture, its history, but especially the culture itself, which is the glue that holds you all together as a people, you see. They will self-destruct and self-annihilate. This is well understood. They even teach this, by the way. They bring in, I don't know if you know that, they brought in big groups of anthropologists who are trained to go in with American troops into Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. And they teach the locals and hire some of them to implement these little seeds of disease, you might call them, to help destroy the societies and self-destruct. Take away, kick down all the posts that held them up as a people. And this is a well-understood technique of total destruction. It's very effective. But say H.G. Wells talked about it. He was a propagandist for the Fabian Society. And the Fabian Society is the left-wing branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs that also runs the right-wing bunches as well. So they were slated for total destruction, Scots and Irish, because they won't adapt totally into submission into this system, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, what surprises people in England and other parts of Europe when I say, well, you know, there's only 5 million people in Scotland. Well, yeah. It might be a bit more now, 5.5, 6 maybe. And the whole of Ireland, north and south, is only about 7.5 million, something like that. And when you look at the land masses of those countries, I mean, Scotland is quite a large chunk of the UK. And, you know, to have 60 million south of the border and only 5 million in Scotland, it's obvious that people have been removed, shall we say, for a better word, or cleared off the land, and the same in Ireland. I mean, you drive through Ireland, and there's odd houses all over the place, but there are no real masses of population, and where there are in Dublin and Galway and Cork, there is mass immigration, the same as there is in the UK. And I've said to people here, if you take the immigrants out of Luton, for example, which I think equates about 60% of the population in Luton now, I think that came out even in the mainstream media, that only 40% were Indigenous English people.
That's right. That's right.
The streets would be empty.
Yeah, and Scotland's getting the same. They've had articles about lots of Eastern Europeans now are flooding into even Scotland. Large Polish populations moving in there too now and so on. So the idea has always been to eradicate those people. It's not just happening there too. It's happening in other European countries as well. What I've done, you see, the Royal Institute for International Affairs they're the guys who set up all policies for immigration in all countries. And there's other tribal groups. I call them tribal groups who are very important in this too. Who also want these countries totally deculturalized to make it safer for what they see as themselves. They lead the charge, actually.
Yeah. I think it was Peter Sutherland, the Goldman Sachs, ex-Goldman Sachs European executive, who stated that the European Union's job was to destroy the homogeneity of the sovereign states by mass immigration. Because, you know, if you have a strong nation, then they stand up against the collective, if you like.
That's right.
We'll go to another piece of music and then we'll come back with, there's so much we could talk about, but you broached on H.G. Wells a couple of times there, and I wanted to talk to you about kind of famous authors who are pushed out into the public sphere as, you know, classical writers or great poets or whatever, or great novelists, and then how they're used to change culture and propagandize as well. So just on the, I suppose, on the subject of immigration, this is...